1490 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Lionel Moyes. The stakes could not be higher, says White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, of a temporary stop for new abortion pill restrictions issued by Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito. It'll give the justices more time to review the case. Formally hearing charges against him in court, Jack Teixeira, accused in the leaking of U.S. military documents to social media, ABC News National Security and Defense Analyst Mick Mulroy.
When it comes to the war in Ukraine, I've looked at all of them. I don't think it's going to change the counteroffensive that's being planned that much. But it's always good to have all the information that you're using to plan something like this large military campaign secret.
President Biden was moved to tears during a stop today at a Catholic shrine in Ireland's County Mayo. He discovered that a chaplain there had performed last rites for his late son, Beau Biden. Montana lawmakers have passed a bill to ban TikTok from operating in the state, the first to do so, a test case expected to face legal challenges. This is ABC News. At least one big bank is raking in profits in the wake of recent banking failures.
Just weeks after a pair of bank failures raised questions about the overall health of the banking industry, earnings numbers from JPMorgan Chase are defying concerns. The nation's largest bank posting a 52% profit increase in the first quarter of this year and revenue up 25% to a record $38 billion. JPMorgan Chase seeing new funds from depositors seeking the safety of too-big-to-fail banks. With higher interest rates, the bank making more money on loan and credit card interest, doubling lending income. Dave Packer, ABC News.
12 U.S. soldiers killed in the Revolutionary War will be reburied in South Carolina later this month. The soldiers were buried in shallow graves after the 1780 Battle of Camden. Archaeologists say several of the fallen were teenagers, and one had a musket ball in his spine. The remains will lie in state at Fort Jackson before a procession to Camden for final burial. Wall Street major indexes closed lower. Lionel Moyes, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Wildfires are raging in Wisconsin for a third straight day. Crews responded to 21 wildfires yesterday, including the 3,000-acre Arcadia fire. Several people have had to evacuate their homes, but we don't know of anyone getting hurt. There's rain and cooler temperatures in the forecast tomorrow. Fires aren't the only problem in Wisconsin. Flooding on the Wisconsin River means several people in Wausau are having to evacuate their homes. Planners say high water not only poses a danger to people who live in flood zones, but to rescue workers who might be called to pull people out. In sports, the Bucks find out their first-round playoff opponent tonight. It'll either be Miami or Chicago. The Brewers beat San Diego last night 4-3. Eric Lauer starts tonight for Milwaukee. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram.
Saturday and Sunday at 1 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving.
Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
You were supposed to get a colon cancer screening, but stuff came up.
We did have to pick up the twins from practice.
But on the way, we hit a giant pothole.
If you are 45 and older, don't let stuff get in the way of your screening. Visit the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at ccalliance.org.
But then...
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Daily at therickssmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Gun Orgy 2023. Yes, the Indiana Convention Center in Indianapolis, Indiana. Gun fetishists, ammo sexuals, AR addicts, mega magazine maniacs, and gunpowder junkies unite. And yes, they are there. And look, all of the GOP attention seekers, all of the people who want to be, you know, something, took the stage on hand to pay homage to the gun. And of course, in front of the unarmed faithful. And that always cracks me up. Always cracks me up that no guns in the gun orgy. Shooting blanks. Nothing there. But I guess I shouldn't be surprised. Now, what I do find interesting on Gun Orgy Day, all the people who come out with their, we've got to be more outrageous, more gun than the last person. And this is how we've gotten to the crazy place where we're at with guns. All of the fetishists and the addicts and the junkies, gotta have it. And it's because we have these policy leaders who want the money. But the right wing of this country has gone way off the flipping end, and they want guns everywhere. In fact, you know, you had Kristi Noem, who, you know, there's a bunch of outrageous stuff in there, but you have Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, who came to Indiana to sign an executive order for South Dakota in Indiana, saying that Indiana would not, or South Dakota would not deal with any corporation, any bank that doesn't support guns. I don't quite know how you're going to enforce that, but it doesn't matter. It's the platitude. It's the hey, look at me. Look what I'm doing for you, gun fetishists. I hope your rod is stiff. Because this is what this is about. Now, she didn't stop just there. No. Evidently, she has a nearly 2-year-old granddaughter, and this nearly two-year-old, already has a shotgun, and she already has a rifle. Isn't it, you know, when I was a kid, this is where, you know, parents would go, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, what is wrong with people who are going to put deadly things in front of their children? No, we want them to stroke it, and they want them to be comforted by it, like the rest of us. It's quite amusing, to be honest. But we're in this weird world. And look, I'm not anti-gun. And I say it all the time. I've got one within arm's reach. I'm not anti-gun. I'm anti where we're going. with guns. I mean, you had Mike Pence in his own state, and I love this, being booed by the faithful, because I guess not gun enough, not mega enough, I don't know. In fact, so bad that he had to start his speech off with, I love you too, which is the right response in that. When everybody is booing you, you got to say something. Words have to be spoken. But Pence, you know, we need to go to the extreme. We need more. We need to be more hardcore. Well, he in his speech said that he's tired of senseless violence, tired of it, and the loss of life that could be prevented if our leaders would support law enforcement, protect our schools, institutionalize the obviously mentally ill, and enact legislation that would ensure that anyone who engages in these heinous acts of mass violence meets their fate in months, not years. Quick little aside, you know, the whole, yeah, we're going to kill them. Most mass shooters, they don't make it out of the event. So we've already we're kind of doing that already, but this did get some applause. Yeah, we're going to kill people. Remember, the pro-life crowd, all in favor of killing people. Now, again, it's not the gun. The gun didn't do all this stuff. It's all these other things. We need to support law enforcement. You know, this is the pro-life party who in Florida, side note, lawmakers there approved a bill that would lower the threshold for the state to use the death penalty. No longer has to be unanimous jury for a death penalty. If one guy says death penalty, we're taking him out back and frying him. Actually, they need 8 of the 12 is what the legislation says. But again, this is the pro-life party. This is the Jesus party. Remember this. Now, Donald Trump, he gave his little spiel, I guess, too. Called for a national concealed carry agreement, reciprocity across state lines. He said, just like your driver's license or your marriage license, your Second Amendment must apply across state lines. And it got me to thinking, you know, most Trumpers I know, now that I'm thinking about it, when they cross state lines, got to empty out the car because you can't take booze across state lines. You can't take cigarettes across state lines in large numbers. No pot, no guns. Eventually, I think they're going to get to, no, take all your vices with you. And I guess maybe that's something that to vote for him for. I don't know. But I'm in this mindset where the Republicans want us to have guns everywhere because there's some belief in whatever patchwork of ideology that they've got, that more guns equates to safety. And I think John Stewart hit it right. When do we hit, you know, peak gun? When does, you know, having, you know, what do we got? Like 5 guns for every person in this country now? When do we hit that safety point? And the reality is never. I mean, we're going to have people do bad things with guns because they're easily accessible. I'm expecting at some point there to be vending machines for guns. And I know there's somebody, I probably just gave a Republican an idea. Oh boy, we can put him in the lunchroom at school. Yes, that'll keep schools safe. Because again, we want cops in every school. Okay, if you want cops in every school, where's the funding bill? Where's the funding bill to do that? Again, lots of nice words. We're going to put cops in every corner. Who's going to pay for it? Well, we're going to arm the teachers. Teachers don't want to be armed. They want to be able to have the resources to teach their class. How about we get them books and computers? Oh, no, we can't trust a teacher with a book. No. But a Glock? Sign them right up. And this is the weird thing. And here's my problem. These folks want everyone carrying concealed weapons. And every incident ends up the shots being thrown. And I look at this thing that happened in Florida. I talked about it, I think, about a week ago, where you had two idiots in a road rage incident throwing shots at each other because somebody, I don't know, threw a cup at the other guy and someone said bad words, made his butt hurt. I don't know what went on, but I know that they ended up shooting at each other and missing each other. Now, I would have been perfectly okay had they hit each other, canceled each other out, we'd be done with both of them. But no, they hit each of the other's kids. I think it was a 5-year-old who got hit in the leg and a 14-year-old that got, you know, shot in the back and had a collapsed lung. know, those are the people who suffered. These two idiots going, I can't take words. I got to shoot at each other. This is the world we're going to now. Concealed carry across all lines. Don't worry, everybody, get the 2-year-old with a gun. Thanks, Christy Noem. Thanks for that. And what's interesting to me is I've talked about this in the past, where we're getting to a point that I shared a story. This has been a while ago. My son and I were heading down the road, returning a van that we rented. Had some moving to do, and we rented this van, and I'm at a stoplight, and this guy who had been tailgating me, losing his mind, comes up to the window and just starts screaming at me. I'm not sure why, but I just reached out the window, and I pushed him in the face and pushed him away from the vehicle and drove off. I asked the question back then, would I have, in conservative land, in stand my ground territory, would I have been able to shoot him? Because, you know, I had no idea what the guy's intentions were. I was in fear of my child's life. I could even say I was in fear of my life. I wasn't, but I've been in those situations before where, you know, when I was a younger man, where you're rolling around in the middle of the street, slapping each other around because someone did something stupid. That happens. But we're now in a world where that's never going to happen again. People are not going to slap each other around. People are not going to roll around on the ground and get up and go, boy, that was dumb. Get back in their cars and drive off. No, we're going to shoot each other. And I'm looking at this, the right wing losing their mind over this Daniel Perry in Texas. For those who don't know, Daniel Perry was driving an Uber, or I guess it's Uber. And there was a crowd of Black Lives Matter protesters. And he had written on his Facebook page that, you know, couldn't wait for this. And look, I know a bunch of people who have said, you know, if I'm ever in that position, I'm just going to run them over. And look, there are now laws. Thank you, Florida. That if there's a protest going on in front of you, you can run the people over. All you got to do is claim, I was in fear of my life. And you can just run them right over. Because again, we're going to take that cop logic. I'm always afraid of my life, so I've got to shoot first. We'll ask questions later. Well, this is what this Daniel Perry admitted to. Because evidently this Garrett Foster, who was an Air Force veteran, had an AK-47 at the protest. Because it's Texas. Why not? You've got Perry, who's got a gun in his car, driving into this crowd. Now, the response is, well, this Garrett Foster came aggressively to the car with his AK-47. He admitted on tape during the interview it was not pointed at him. Now, this is where I've often said you've got two idiots. There's some heat going on. I may have to shoot you just because. I may have to shoot first because I have to fear that you're going to shoot me first. So now we're going to start dueling in the streets. Now, this guy, rightfully so, as I see it, was found guilty. He admitted the guy didn't point a gun at him. He just pulled out shot, I guess, like 5 shots. And when they went back and looked at all his social media posts, and again, people, stop writing your hatred down. Because here's the thing, much like your Miranda rights, when you talk to a cop, social media can and most certainly will be used against you in a court of law. So all of the things that Perry put on his websites and on those crazy, you know, 4chans or wherever he was, bit him in the behind. Because he came off as a racist. He came off as someone who would do exactly what he said he would do. And he did it. So this is one of those moments where I have to ask, you know, when do we as a society say, you know what, we've gone too far with this? Look, I'm in favor of people having guns in their home, protecting their homes. If you're really flipped out by it, I'm not quite sure on the concealed carry stuff because it leads to this kind of stuff. And my problem has always been, from the beginning, always been, when two idiots start throwing shots at each other, I know if I'm nearby, they're going to both hit me. And they're going to walk away scot-free. Because I go back to that story of the two guys in Florida, the one who shot the 5-year-old, the one who shot the 14-year-old. Evidently, the guy who shot one of the kids isn't going to be charged with anything. That kid had nothing to do with it. But because it was ruled, well, you know, we ruled that the other person acted in self-defense. Because I guess there was a cup thrown or something. Instead of just saying, you know what, your responsibility is to get away. And if you're backed into a corner, this is where the stand your ground law stuff is really dangerous. If you don't have to make an effort to get away, then you're going to have more of these shootings. And I got to wonder how many people are thinking like I am. The next time someone raises their voice, the next time someone walks at me aggressively, might have to shoot them. Because I don't know anymore. I'm curious your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Thursday, Vice President Kamala Harris wrapped up the Biden administration's Invest in America tour. Did that in Washington, D.C. at the I-395 Arlen D. Williams Jr. Memorial Bridge. That's the bridge that connects Northern Virginia and Washington, D.C. I've been on it a million times. Needs help. And she announced a $72 million bit of funding to help repair that bridge. Something like 80, 90,000 people a day cross over that bridge. But she also, while there on Thursday, talking about that bridge, talked about the fact that, you know, $300 million in bipartisan infrastructure bill funding has been allocated to bridges across 8 states and the District of Columbia. They're going to be either repaired or replaced. Now, this was the last stop on the administration's 3-week Invest in America tour, as I said. But it's been reported that, you know, and I, you can't get a lot of information because our media structure just didn't care. But it's been reported that some 20 representatives of the administration were out traveling to more than 50 cities across the country, across 25 states, to talk about the $435 billion in funding that are going to fund 23,000 projects across the country in 4,500 cities. Many of those cities that didn't vote for Biden. Now, again, you look at the fact that our bridges and our infrastructure, our roads and stuff falling down. I guess as of right now, the number is something like 4,600 of the nation's bridges have been or are currently being repaired or replaced. This is enormous. And this is something that, you know, our mainstream media, we've got to talk about things that divide us. This is the stuff that we should be thrilled about, that we're getting good infrastructure in our communities. We're getting good jobs for people in our communities, and all of that, that positive movement that brings us back into the middle of the road. You know, I often say, you know, the one thing that I when a new road comes in, I'm thrilled because I now know I'm not going to have to align my front end again. But where I live in Pennsylvania, the pothole capital of the U.S., yeah, that happens a lot. So the fact that we're doing something on infrastructure is incredibly important to me. And look, it was one of the things that I said from the beginning of the Trump administration. Had Trump's first piece of legislation been, you know, a massive infrastructure bill, had he focused on that stuff, he would have been unbeatable. in 2020. Had he focused on bringing jobs and focused on making communities better off, had he done that, had he put aside all the nonsense and the stupidity and all of the shows, because we had a lot of, I'll be honest, he puts on a nice party, especially on taxpayers' money, puts on a really nice party, a really nice show of Infrastructure Week, if you remember, but we didn't do anything. And this is why I'm thrilled to see that Biden is doing this. And it's what we need to be doing. And I had someone again, tell me, well, we can't afford this. And you go, we absolutely can. And we could afford much more if it weren't for how insane our tax code is. As we talked about earlier in the week, just the Bush tax cuts and the Trump tax cuts alone were $10 trillion. Trillion with a T. $10 trillion. We could have easily done everything on the American Society of Civil Engineers wish list. We could have even done fantasy stuff. You could have gone to the engineers and go, if you woke up in the middle of a dream, what would you fund? We would have that kind of money. But sadly, what we're seeing is just a massive redistribution of wealth from working people to the very wealthy through our tax code, through the greedflation we're all suffering from. And I saw, Biden put out an Instagram post saying that, inflation is down from its peak. And I think he said 45% from its peak. No, things are coming down and that's good. But not fast enough. Not fast enough for working people. And I want hearings. I want lots of hearings to go after these corporations. Because as we've been talking about, I think one of the biggest stories that's not being discussed at all is this French economist. This Albert Edwards, who is the global strategist for this Societe Generale Bank, saying, look, in all of his years, he's never seen anything like the unprecedented and astonishing levels of corporate greed. And look, we've always had corporate greed, but not like this. And as he said, look, if the super normal profit margins that we see now, if that becomes the norm, he says, look, it's going to inflame social unrest. If working people can't afford to keep a roof over their head, understand 39% of working people are missing a meal to pay their rent or pay their mortgages. In the wealthiest country in the world, that's unacceptable. And as he said, we may be looking at the end of capitalism. And I've been saying this for a while. When a handful control the unimaginable amount of wealth that they have in their hands and are able to do whatever it is that they want to us. When do the pitchforks come out? When do people start pushing back? Now, you could say that's what Trump was, and I agree. Trump, to a degree, was a pushback to our loss of manufacturing jobs, to the fact that communities are broken because those factories abandoned them. I was right there and still am. I still believe those communities need to be dealt with because they're not enough. But the credit I give Biden is there's money going into those places now. And I've had friends who say, the heck with those red counties, the heck with those red states, screw them. And there's a part of me that goes, screw them. But if we're going to be the United States, we got to be united. And we got to find those things that bring us together. Jobs, infrastructure, those things bring us together. We've got to stop being allowed to be divided on this stuff. And for me, let's talk tax code. I've said for a long time, we should be cutting taxes at the bottom, raising them at the top. Much like the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower, who invested enormously in infrastructure and had a top marginal tax rate of 92% on individuals making over, I think it's like $1.6 million in today's dollars. Corporations over a certain percentage were paying 56% tax rate. We weren't massively in debt. We were paying for our wars. We were investing in our future. And we didn't have oligarchs who controlled everything we touch. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1975. That was the day union representatives at Bunker Hill Mining Company in Kellogg, Idaho, were notified of a policy change. The lead and zinc producer had decided to exclude fertile women from working in lead-exposed environments. Women workers had to provide a doctor's note stating they were infertile, postmenopausal, or had been sterilized. Otherwise, they would be transferred to safer departments at a substantial loss in pay. 29 women took the transfer, while at least three opted for sterilization. During World War II, companies like Bunker Hill promised millions of women workers that they would eliminate hazards through engineering controls. In the 1970s, a new wave of women gained work in several industries that used occupational safety language to implement exclusionary policies like the one at Bunker Hill. These took the form of outright bans on hiring of women, either altogether or in many departments considered too toxic for women of childbearing years. It meant the real loss of well over 100,000 potential industrial jobs for women. Employers could have provided actual protection through better medical coverage and benefits, installation of engineering controls, or protections to include men's reproductive health. Instead, these policies served to roll back economic and civil rights of women workers, regardless of whether they were mothers or ever planned to be. The women appealed to their union, state and federal commissions, and OSHA, but faced an uphill battle. OSHA initially fined Bunker Hill for outstanding violations and its sterilization policy, but dropped the case once Ronald Reagan took office. The women eventually won wage equivalency in their new jobs, but women working in heavy industry would continue to battle such policies for more than a decade. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
It's always instructive to hear powerful political officials declare that in the name of democracy, they must usurp the people's democratic authority. This has become all too common, as even so-called democratic regimes in France and Israel have infuriated their people by trying to ram vastly unpopular anti-democratic schemes into law by executive fiat. Luckily, though, our U.S. of A. remains committed to the people's rule, right? Moreover, our leaders agree that local government is best for its closest to the people, right? No, and no. Since the once conservative Republican Party has turned extremist and downright goofy during the past decade, its governors and lawmakers have become knee-jerk autocrats, imposing their unpopular policies through a crude power play called preemption. This is the despotic use of arbitrary state power to cancel any town, city, or county policies that Republican politicians don't like. Preemption is an extreme governing tool meant to be rarely used in emergency situations. But GOP-controlled state houses in Florida, Texas, Ohio, and elsewhere now use it routinely as an ideological sledgehammer, crushing the right of local people to govern themselves. This has led extremist Republican officials force some of their racist, homophobic, and xenophobic nastiness on communities that vehemently oppose them. But most Republican preemptions are issued in service to corporate elites. For example, when local communities try to raise the minimum wage or prevent corporate money from corrupting local politics, corporate-serving governors rush to outlaw the people's will. This is Jim Hightower saying Texas lawmakers are even trying to supersize and privatize preemption with a blanket decree that all local ordinances restricting corporations are overruled by state law.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Monday, the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE, held a press conference to talk about the Social Security Administration. And look, a lot of what we see in our government has been underfunded and on purpose. The old Grover Norquist, we want to make government so small we can drag it in the bathtub and drown it. And what happens when they do that? When people who tell you they don't believe in government and government can't do anything and we need to slash and burn, they then act surprised when service isn't where it should be and people are struggling to get the services that they need. This is why the good folks at AFGE are saying, hey, look, we need Congress to act. And that's why I've asked Jessica LaPointe to come talk with us. She's the president of AFGE SSA Council 220. They're the Social Security Administration people. You want to check out their website, AFGEC220.org. Jessica, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rick. I appreciate it.
So walk me through Monday's press conference. What's the ask? What was the point?
So the point of the press conference on Monday was to really bring the focus to the American people on what we're going through at the Social Security Administration internally, and how that is affecting customer service. How we're at a historic attrition crisis within the agency. Our staffing is at a 25-year low, and how it's driving a historic public service crisis to the American people. You know, Social Security is a program that 67 million beneficiaries utilize annually, every month. And it is to keep the nation's most vulnerable people afloat. It's our social safety net. It is something that is vital to this nation and a lifeline to many, many people. And we're in crisis, and we need to sound the alarm on that, and things need to change if we're going to continue to be able to provide these services that Americans have bought in, paid for, depend on, and taxpayers want to see it run efficiently. And we want to talk more about how we can do that.
Yeah, it is the greatest anti-poverty program that I think we've ever come up with in this country, because we took seniors who, you know, years ago were living in poverty, you know, the stories of eating cat food because they didn't have, were abound. We don't see that today. The poverty rate for seniors is much, much lower than it's probably ever been in the history of humanity. So what you guys do is really important. But I think it's interesting to point out, you know, as you said, you have this attrition problem. And I think that's across the board. As people are retiring from your organization, they're retiring from other places. So you're kind of in a burning the candle at both ends. You're losing qualified people. You're losing your best people who are retiring, and good for them. And then as more Americans are retiring, your demand is higher. So why aren't we seeing more urgency coming out of our elected officials?
That's a great question.
Well, because look, if I'm just a dumb truck driver, if I can figure this out, that the more people are retiring, the more demand we're going to have, and you're losing people, there should be some urgency, don't you think? I know there are some who want to destroy it, and you know we need to push it off for another decade or whatever their scheme is. But right now, people need it, and they need the services. They need to be able to pick up the phone and talk to somebody. They need to be able to get what they've earned.
That is correct. The time is now, as they say at AFGE, to fully fund this agency and get us out of the crisis that we're in. I mean, it takes more than funding, right? It takes leadership with a vision. It takes strong leadership with a will to treat their employees with dignity and respect. We often feel like, the union often feels like at the Social Security Administration, that we're dealing with an agency in denial. A denial that we're in an attrition crisis, and employees are leaving about at a rate of about 1,000 a month, or they were just a few months ago. The agency will tell you this is slowing down, but it's not. We hear from the employees every day about how they're just burnt out and they're just fed up. And, you know, this is coming from the employees themselves. We've been surveying, and basically a very high percentage, almost 90%, say that they're going on medication related to work-related stress, that they are leaving the agency because of the mounting caseloads. You know, every time an employee leaves because the pay is not adequate enough to deal with the highly technical nature of the programs and the often difficulties we have with customers and the stress that everybody is feeling because of the logjam of service. Employees are getting burnt out, and every time somebody leaves because of that, a mountain of work is just dumped on the employees that stay. So anytime an employee has an opportunity to leave, they do. And we're seeing our survey's results are showing that over half of employees surveyed are making plans to leave with the agency within the next year. So the time is now to address this crisis. The time is now to raise pay for SSA workers. The union has proposed retention pay incentives to keep employees on, stop the brain drain. We're seeing a lot of seasoned employees, journeymen, journey women, employees who are leaving because they just can't handle the stress anymore, and they just want to go anywhere else to work.
And I understand it. Look, Jessica, I understand. In the world that we're in right now, in the post COVID world where people have short fuses and are not nice to each other, I don't know that I want to be on the other end of the phone with half of America. I don't know that I want to have to deal with you know, going through complex issues with people who want to have nothing of it because they don't respect what you do. I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I mean, employees, Federal Employee Viewpoint Surveys show that employees are drawn to this line of work because they believe that their purpose is serving the common good, that they overwhelmingly 90% believe that. I think it was like 76% align with the mission of the agency. They want to help. They're driven to public service. And yet, when they onboard and they start the process, many of them leave before they're able to get fully trained because it's just not what they thought. Right. The workloads are too much. You're right. The customer base is disgruntled because of the long wait times. It now takes over 7 months to get initial disability decision back. It takes over 35 minutes on average to get your call answered from our 1-800 number. And there are 4.2 million items backlog at our payment center. Wow. Where a customer is associated with that item, right? Whether it's correcting their benefit amount, getting paid, things like that. So there's just customer service is all but halted at this point. Employees are leaving, and we need Congress to do something. We need this agency to modernize their approach to personnel management so we can just get out of this and move forward. I mean, you want to talk about the attacks from Congress just on the program itself. Well, this is like a death by a thousand cuts situation. It's getting it's sort of imploding from the inside, and then, you know, the attacks on the outside, and we just want solutions at this point.
Right. No, this is where I'm going to be political, so you can turn your ears off. This is where all of the, we need to freeze spending on all government agencies. We need to do something like screw Questor back during the Obama years to cut funding. You know, it's just 2% across mm-hmm. the board for agencies like yours that are already struggling to hold on to qualified people. They know what they're doing. They know they're creating a crisis. They know that they've poison-pilled these agencies. So now you can turn your ears back on. How do we start demanding that you get the funding? I understand you want an additional $2 billion to run the Social Security Administration. I think, you know, getting qualified people, younger people in, people who are willing to stay, I think that's kind of maybe, I don't know, worth the investment. Thoughts?
Yeah, so that's twofold. You unpacked a lot there. So first of all, the American people need to start to demand from their local U.S. congressional leaders that they hold town halls, and we need to get Social Security back into the conversation locally within communities. You know, Social Security keeps people out of poverty. It keeps people out of incarceration. It keeps people purchasing homes. It keeps people from bankruptcy. You know, it feeds and clothes over a million children annually, gives people the financial means to have an education, and it does things like closes the gap on racial inequalities and the gender gap. And in terms of wages, it does a lot. It stabilizes this country. It is vital to this country. And we need to start to have those conversations at a local level, demand that our congressional leaders hold town halls and hold everyone accountable in Washington for what their stance is on Social Security. Do they want it to sunset? Do they believe in it, this 87-year-long success story? Do they want to fully fund it once and for all? You're right. Sequester happened. 10 years of that Budget Control Act, you know, forced us to make really difficult decisions with how we spend the money that got lifted in October of last year. So we need to start to fully fund this program, and we need to hire leadership, right? Taxpayers, this is taxpayers now, needs to hire leadership, demand that, you know, the Biden administration appoint, Congress confirm a permanent commissioner that is willing to make these modern personnel decisions, right? Like expand telework where it makes sense, create remote work programs where workloads are fully portable, like at our teleservice centers and our workload support units, so we can start to recruit the best and the brightest workforce from all over the country, right? People that are dedicated to public service, that that want to do this job, and improve our training models. Our training models are sorely inadequate for the complexity of the workloads and for the modern workforce. And we need to start to just infuse resources and time, dedication and energy into this program so it becomes sustainable, right? But we're not going to be able to do that at this point without everybody starting to talk about Social Security, whether it's at, you know, their holiday table, or whether it's, you know, conversations in knitting clubs and holding these town halls and getting it back into the minds of the American people that this is something that we need, that everybody has bought and paid into, and this is something that we want to carry on for our future generations.
Yeah, and something that's good for the country as a whole, to have a safety net to ensure that no one falls through. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Jessica LaPointe. She's the president of AFGE's Social Security Administration Council. 220, AFGEC220.org is their website. You know, for me, I when my mother passed when I was 13, I moved in with my grandparents, and it was the disability benefit that helped my grandparents to be able to take me in and pay the enormous grocery bill that came with me. And I still remember that. You know, it's one of those things that there are parts of this that I don't think a lot of people spend enough talking about, and how vital it is for families, not just seniors, and that by destroying the disability benefit or the death benefit or any of that, it's going to be a major hit to our safety net.
You're right, Rick. I mean, I share a similar story, to take it personal for a moment. I mean, you know, I remember it vividly. The worst day of my life, my father died when I was 9 years old, 1989. And the beacon of light in that very dark time for our family was that my mother was just able to call up her local Social Security office, get an appointment, talk with a well-trained, compassionate human being, get those benefits started with relative ease, and not have any hiccups with it throughout the course of my childhood, my three brothers' childhood. And we had a dignified life. I got an education. And now, because of that and because of this program, I'm able to sit here with you today and advocate for strengthening it. And I think probably almost every American has a story like that. That was 35 years ago. Nowadays, the stories are going to be much more negative, unfortunately, because of the logjam of service that has been created by underfunding and this sort of lack of leadership that we've been talking about. And it's sad. And we want to get back to that. We want to get back to this sense of pride in this program, that it's here for us. when we need it, that, you know, the mission of the agency is to deliver every check on time to everybody that needs a check. And we need to really get back to that mission.
There you go. Last question I've got for you. Got an email from someone who asks, you know, why can't we privatize the Social Security Administration and Social Security as a whole? Because this person believes that a private entity would have done this better. I fundamentally push back on that, but I'm curious your thoughts.
No, absolutely not. Privatizing Social Security, America's social safety net, leaving it to the whims of the market to crash like it did in 2008 and how it does, you know, historically, we can't leave our nation's most vulnerable subjected to that. We need to just fully fund the program, stop messing around, stop having delusions of privatization. All that does is makes rich people even richer, on the backs of people who are barely scraping by. It makes no sense to me.
I'm with you. Jessica, I appreciate the time. I hope folks will call their representatives early, call them often. This is something that we have to save and continue for future generations. Jessica LaPointe, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Absolutely. Thank you. Have a nice night.
You as well. Remember, check out the website, afgec220.org is the website if you want to find out more information. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1930. That was the day that 114 agricultural laborers in California's Imperial Valley paid a harsh price for joining together to try and improve their working conditions. The Great Depression was worsening the already difficult conditions faced by California farm laborers. The workers had gathered at a hall in El Centro, a city in the valley. The meeting was called together by the cannery and agricultural workers Industrial Union. The union often faced great opposition because some of its leaders had communist ties. The meeting in Imperial Valley included many Filipino and Mexican workers, along with white and black laborers. One by one, the workers stood up and told their stories of harsh labor performed under the unforgiving California sun. Suddenly, the door of the hall burst open. In poured armed sheriff's deputies and gun-toting thugs hired by the growers. At their head was Sheriff Gillette. Every single worker at the meeting was arrested. They were chained together, loaded into the back of trucks, and transported to the county jail. There, they were charged with violating the Criminal Syndicalism Act. During the first Red Scare of the 20th century, California was one of 20 states to enact laws criminalizing syndicalism. 9 stood trial in front of Superior Court Judge Von Thompson. 3 Mexican workers were ordered deported. The remaining 6 were convicted and sentenced to between 2 and 42 years in prison. They were ordered to serve hard time either at Folsom State Prison or San Quentin. Judge Thompson declared that, for communists, anything less than a life sentence was lenient. In 1933, the final 2 prisoners were released from prison. Organizing California farm workers was a long and difficult campaign that faced great opposition.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I gotta tell you, to see what's going on with the Social Security Administration, understand it's all by plan. You go back to that sequester back during the Obama years. It was about shrinking the size of these agencies. It was about starving them. It was about doing the Grover Norquist thing. Make government so small, so underfunded that you can drag it in the bathtub and drown it in the bathtub, which means less service for you and me. And that's the game plan. Let's go to the phones. Got David on line 1 from Milwaukee. David, what's on your mind?
Hey, Rick, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Anytime. What's up?
Really quickly, so I was listening to your guest, and one of the things that people should remember, and it sounds like she was born in 1980, In 1983, I want to say, or 1984, when Biden was senator, the idea came up with, let's tax Social Security. And we've had that in place ever since. And what I think is really disgusting is the fact that we are essentially retaxing something that people already had taxes taken out for it. So it's almost like double dipping. And I personally feel that seniors today, the reason why, and let's be honest, Rick, reason why Florida is booming, reason why Texas is booming, reason why Tennessee is booming is there is no state income tax. Seniors are flocking there because they know they don't have to least worry about having their Social Security tax at a state level. Whereas in California, where my aunt lives, depending on what bracket you're in, you can be taxed all the way up to 14% additional in the state of California.
Yeah, I was against the Social Security tax from the beginning, much like I was against them at that same time period taxing unemployment benefits. Now, I would argue the other side of this, a lot of the money that the federal government puts into those states makes up for the loss in state tax revenue, and we pick up the other side of that.
Well, if you look at this, though, Rick, the one thing I will disagree with you on one part. If you look where most of the jobs are being created, they are actually, Texas has been leading the way for like the last 15, 20 years. Like they've produced almost half of all the jobs in the United States. And now what you're seeing is Florida is becoming a robust, if you look at Miami, that is a international city.
Yep. I've spent a lot of time down there, David. There's a lot of Russian money there.
There's Russian, there's a lot of everything down there. Yep. But again, my point is, if you look at what's happening is, you know, you have to follow where the money is. And the money flows where you have the least amount of restrictions. People don't realize in New York City, they actually have a rent tax. If you're as a, let's say you have a restaurant and you're renting, and you know, listen, rents in New York City are this outlandish.
Because people want to be there.
If you're over $20,000 a month, they came up with the idea, hey, let's tax the small business owner 6%, anything over 20%. I mean, over $20,000, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know that
so
to be
New York City.
I don't know that to be accurate. I think that's awful low.
You can look it up.
I will.
Look it up. I swear to God.
But let me ask you this, because I have to go here in a second. So if we're eliminating all the tax revenue that comes in to do the things that we the people want, where does the money come from?
Mm-hmm. Well, so there really has to be, if you look at what we're actually doing, where is the money going to right now? And a lot of it is the fact that we're borrowing money that it's being passed on to the next generation. If you go on the national debt clock, today,
I know what the debt is, and I would argue that the Trump tax cuts and the Bush tax cuts added about $10 trillion to that, as the Reagan tax cuts of the 80s did as well.
There was no cut in federal spending. The federal spending increased as well with the additional tax cuts.
No, actually, we are actually under. The spending that we were, you know, 20 years ago. Spending has been going down.
I'm not sure if you're spending $6 trillion a year, I'm not sure how we're underspending. I think we're carelessly throwing money around and things, you know, and not getting a full audit. And we're not getting a full, when I say that, Milwaukee has this problem, Philadelphia has this problem. If you look at low-income housing, and you see how low-income housing is just failing people that are there currently with mold and mice and everything else that you can think of, there's absolutely no anything. There's no oversight on this.
And that's,
so there's
that's a
literally
problem.
This money that being is, shoveled out the door
that's a problem.
Without any oversight.
David, I appreciate the call, man. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Look, you know, there's a lot of this stuff that we have to deal with. Now, where I'm going to disagree with David is, you know, the fact that spending has been coming down as a portion of our GDP There are so many things that we should be investing in. He's right. There should be oversight in those kind of places. I grew up in a housing project. I know exactly the kind of waste and the kind of mismanagement that happens when you're dealing with poor people because they're always defunded. But I appreciate the call. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News.